Well, hello and welcome to another episode of the Capitol Record. I am your host, David Bahnsen, and I am thrilled today to have another guest. As we get ready to wrap up our second year of Capitol Record, we are still finding wonderful first-time guests, and hopefully you've been able to listen to some of the recent episodes. I think we've had some really, really fascinating conversations. I loved our talk with Dr. Alexander Salter last week about monetary policy. We got a lot of great feedback on that. And hopefully we will continue finding great first-time guests. And that's what we have again here today. Many of you should already be familiar with FreedomWorks, profoundly important organization in terms of the cause of liberty. The notion of a distinct view of government that matches the view of our founders, quite a legacy in history. And their current president and CEO, who has been with the organization for a very long time, is my guest today, Adam Brandon. Adam, welcome for the very first time to National Review's Capitol Record.
Oh, I really appreciate it. And it's funny, I remember back in 2004 when I took this job, I was so sure I'd stay here for at least 2 years.
Yeah. Well, how's that going for you? You're coming up on 20. It's a good thing they don't have term limits in the private
sector. I've made a couple jokes. Like, I'd never thought I would be. I was always one of those people who assumed I'd be bouncing around in my career. I had no idea I'd be a lifer at one place, but I guess I found a home and something I'm enjoying. And there's always a new challenge. And that's one thing that's interesting about working in this more political realm is just when you think things are kind of settling down, they blow up right in your face.
Well, so you've been there for coming up on 20 years, and there's been a lot of changes and things within the organization. You're now in the role that you're in, and I am curious within the freedom movement and the broader objectives that you guys have as an organization, what you see happening across the landscape in American right-wing politics and particularly just the overall conservative philosophy that favors limited government and fiscal responsibility and other prehistoric, ancient medieval concepts like that. What is your take right now? Are you optimistic? Are you pessimistic? Let's try to have a lay of the land conversation and at least for the next 2 minutes, not say the words Donald Trump.
Ah, that sounds great to me. Now, honestly, I found myself optimistic. And I think it's because I thought of the negative trends that I do see. I think that you're seeing what the future is holding with behind the negative trends in politics. So obviously this last election to me, the big winner in this election was the independent voter. It was not the Republican or the Democrat. It reminded me of trying to prognosticate over World War I where, okay, the Republicans took the House, so they moved forward 5 yards there, and the Democrats are taking the Senate, so they moved forward 5 yards there. But the battle lines are roughly exactly in the same place. And it's fascinating to think if I was actually going to look forward in the next cycle, chances are you give up seats in the House that you took in the midterm. That's how history tells you. So based on history, you're looking at Republicans probably losing the House by 10 in the next cycle. I then think that what's interesting about the Senate map for 2024, there are 9 Democrats in states that either Donald Trump won or are swing states. There are 0 Republicans under that category. So the chances right now, Republicans take the Senate in 24. I'm going to say that's pretty good. And then the White House, it's the man that you said we're not going to speak of. What does he decide to do? Right now, I would say that Ron DeSantis is really doing well amongst our grassroots activists right now. But the question is, if Donald Trump leaves the scene either by losing the primary or whatnot, what happens to his voter? Because it'd be very difficult in the short run, medium run, meaning like 2024, for Republicans to win if 5%, 10% of Donald Trump's diehard supporters leave with him if he doesn't win in the primary. So I watch that, but I'm also watching right now as we sit here. I am not sure Kevin McCarthy is going to be the next speaker. I'm just not convinced of that.
Is that what you're hoping for or what you're predicting? I mean, I'm sure it's the former, but is it really what you're predicting?
Honestly, here's what I would hope happened from my perspective. The Freedom Caucus has put out things like, we want 72 hours to read a bill before you vote on it. So if Kevin McCarthy would say, okay, guys, we'll give you 72 hours before you vote on a bill, they also want to restore something called the motion to vacate, which is, if we don't like your job, we can have a no confidence vote. If McCarthy accepts that, I'm totally thrilled to have a McCarthy speakership. I think that that's kind of the insurance policy that the Freedom Caucus is looking for right now. If McCarthy can't tell members of the House, we can't trust you with a piece of legislation for 72 hours, then no, I don't think he deserves the job.
Well, I don't want to get you in trouble because there's people that you got to deal with day in, day out. I'll tell you my take on it. Mm-hmm. I think that the early stages Freedom Caucus, we're just doing some of the most important patriotic things that we've seen back in the day. And then there was a little period of time I don't want to talk about where I didn't know what in the world was really going on. And it wasn't the Freedom Caucus I'd fallen in love with. And I think I want a Freedom Caucus in the legislative house. Yep. To stand up to any president who wants to abusively spend, regardless of what the political affiliation or the grassroots popularity of that president may be.
David, I just got to jump in because maybe this will get me in trouble. But when the Freedom Caucus was founded, I remember talking to these members, Justin Amash, Matt Salmon, Raul Labrador, and what they were fighting for with Boehner was the opportunity to offer amendments on spending. I'm a spending guy. That's why I came to this town. That's all. They didn't care if they got their butts beaten in the amendment. They just wanted the opportunity for that amendment. Then you go through a Freedom Caucus phase where they become the Trump Defense Force. And yes. I think that's probably what and that to me is not what the Freedom Caucus is supposed to be. The Freedom Caucus should be about offering amendments on spending issues. And if that's what they're doing, I'm all on board. So I think what's going to be interesting to see, though, is now that you're going to be in the majority, are you going to be able to be that role, which is going to be the spending guys, or is it going to become the Taylor Greene show? But they're gonna have to decide what they are. And, I hope they are they're going to be the group that's focusing on offering amendments on spending.
So suffice it to say, we agree. The only thing is that I might agree with you more than you agree with you. That's how much I agree with you.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I actually am pretty staunch on this. I don't want to break news here, but I have talked with many members of the Freedom Caucus over time that have talked about leaving the Freedom Caucus because they're like, I'm not sure we're really focusing on these core, fiscal things that we should. And all of those members are still there right now. So it remains to be seen. It's a living thing. And I hope it becomes the energy center for the GOP House, where it actually is like, okay, we do have to be responsible about all of these fiscal decisions, and not just we're going to oppose. And I guess my concern is your concern. It's one thing to oppose Biden spending, but were you opposing Trump spending? And I think it's very important that these guys not only line up to try and rein in spending under Biden, but whoever is president the next couple of years, that should be their long-term legacy.
Well, I would even say that they're connected in ways that we don't always think about. There's the hypocrisy argument. Don't stand up to Obama and Biden about spending and not stand up to Bush and Trump about spending. That's a fair argument for consistency and whatnot. But I would argue that nobody really is able to effectively stand up to Biden spending if they didn't stand up to Trump spending, because the national conversation has changed. The March or April of 2021 spending bill, which again, I'm not here to rail on Trump, and we're going to go into other economic things here in a moment. That $2,000 handout that Biden did, that was a Trump bill.
We had polling that said at the beginning of COVID, it was 70-30, the amount of Americans who disagreed with direct handouts. After that, we went back in the field and it flipped. 70% of Americans said, yeah, I'm okay with that. And that was just disgraceful at the end. And I will say, you could look at my record, my op-eds. I've always been opposing the spending, whether Republican or Democrat. And then there's other members of leadership that I look to. Like I've had a kind of a sore spot with Lee Stefanik and some of the spending that she's kind of shepherded through. That being said, it's a new Congress. I try and give people an opportunity to try and lead a little bit here. So I'm trying to look forward, and right now I'm kind of a glasses half full kind of guy. But hey, you know, I'm hoping that they are successful.
So would you say that Freedom Work, you know, I'm involved with the Acton Institute, which is a think tank that is not so much partisan and political, but exists for making a philosophical case for liberty and a market economy and a free and virtuous society. National Review is a more political organization fighting for first principles, conservative things. Freedom Works.
And they have great cruises too. Don't forget about the Freedom National Review cruise.
I think that when it comes to Freedom Works, I've always thought of it as really being at the vanguard of fighting for fiscal responsibility and limited government. Would you say that Freedom Works has a broader objective, or is that the kind of narrow niche you've chosen for yourself by design?
That's where we like to be. A lot of people describe us as libertarian leaning, but what I want to do is, I mean, honestly, here's a visual I want to try and be. When you watch left wingers show up at the Capitol with T-shirts of support this judicial nominee, I like trying to be the guys on the other side who are supporting our nominee. I'm trying to build an organization that could go toe to toe with a lot of these progressive activist groups. But our issues are not guns. Our issues are not going to be abortion. Our issues are the fiscal size and scope of government issues. I used to say we don't do social, but it's amazing that capitalism has become a social issue now.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I talk about it all the time. Now, see, I've never been in that position where my conservatism was only focused on one of the three-legged stools, although I understand some groups from a division of labor standpoint have an emphasis, whether it's national defense, anti-communism, social issues, fiscal. I do believe that we're living in a time where a defensive markets will be inseparable from a defensive family.
ESG. It's all of that stuff.
That's right.
Watching that, I mean, that is one of the most insidious things. You can win the House, you can win the Senate, you can win all the political battles. You lose this war on ESG, everything changes. You've fundamentally changed and weaponized capitalism and not you know, we were talking earlier about how I just had a baby, and so many of the problems facing this country, a lot of them come down to demographic problems. And it also comes down to what you're teaching your kids in school. I mean, so these are, I guess you'd say they're capitalism issues, not just social issues now. And you got to engage.
Well, and I think a lot of it is that we were content in talking philosophically more than politically. We were content in a post-Randian moment, and GDP growth was just so gosh darn good in the 80s and the 90s. Right. With both a Republican and a Democrat president, you had no chance of winning if you didn't talk about the era of big government's over, if you weren't deregulatory to some degree. There were obviously differences between Bill Clinton and Ronald Reagan, but you know, the country's mood was pro-growth, pro-prosperity. Financial crisis changed all that. It brought back class envy, and it invited a conversation that was now not going to be fundamentally policy-oriented. It was going to be philosophical. And that's where I think, you know, and it sounds like you're right there with me, but I think groups like Freedom Works should lean into a philosophical, a moral defense of markets.
But you 100%, but I think one thing that's happened, when you're writing history books 50 years from now, The Russian invasion of Ukraine moment became the end of the post-Cold War era. And I spent most of my life growing up in the post-Cold War era, and foreign policy didn't really matter so much. Things seemed to be pretty, pretty good as an American growing up. So I think you did have 9/11, which was kind of a challenge to the post-Cold War era. Then you had the financial crisis, as you mentioned. And then I think this is the final bookend of that. And so, but that's an interesting time to live, because we're going to start reevaluating everything. I bring up the point that my wife is 10 years younger than me, and she was born in 1988. She doesn't remember the fall of the Berlin Wall. And so if you use a phrase, she's a PhD in nuclear science, and the word socialism doesn't really mean anything to her because it didn't mean anything to her when she was growing up. So if my wife, who is pretty, you know, I mean, she's a pretty, I think you would say pretty moderate Republican voter per se. The fact that even she, you know, she doesn't have a philosophical underpinning of a lot of these issues because she hasn't had to. And now we're getting into the era where that is, you know, like these childhood depression rates you keep reading about and some of those struggles. I think a lot of that is that, like, what is the ethos of the country? And people feel lost.
Well, I think that that is a existential issue that speaks to the vision that the founders had, our view of economics, our view of social cooperation, that it does presuppose a virtuous people, a spiritually rooted people, and that the notion of economic living, prospering, and being optimal, disconnected from people having a vibrant identity, people having an optimism, right, people being happy to be alive.
People, and I've noticed in my life, when they're creating something is when they're the happiest. Well, so if you're an artist and you're creating a piece of art, you're happy. If you're a football player and you're creating a play, you're happy. If you're creating a business, if you're creating a family, you're creating this act of creation is what gives human beings so much joy. And oppose that to being a bureaucrat and showing up in the same office every day and pushing the same pencils and paper, that just ebbs. And I always felt so sorry when I hear for people that say, I only live for the weekend. And if that's what you're going through life to do is just using Monday through Friday to get through to Saturday, Sunday, that's not living. That's not living at all. And so I want to, I think that, well, that's one of my favorite things about the United States is the creativity, and it's pretty loud and messy, but I love visiting Tokyo, and London is a great city, but there's just an energy about New York that is just, that's so American and exciting. And if you turn your back on that, I used to think I was doing this stuff to try and do my part to help the country, but I know it's cliche now, but it's really about Western civilization and humanity and reason now at this point than it is just trying to do what's good for the country.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. You don't know this, but what you're describing is the new book I'm writing in 2023. it will come out February 24, but I'm doing a pretty exhaustive, comprehensive book in defense of work, but not merely there's the obvious side that we on the right have been pretty good about forever. It's a sort of rugged individualism. Hard work is good. Get up and work, take responsibility for your life. I agree with all of that, but I'm really trying to lean into the part that you're saying, because I think it's much more timely, that we were made to create, not just the football player made to create the play, the artist made to create the painting, but human beings made to produce. Mm-hmm. And so there's a deeply theological and anthropological case for human identity being tied to human activity. I think it's one of the things that the Austrian camp that you and I both have a lot of sympathies for, that they got so profoundly right, that there is human action and rationality and instinct around human behavior. And yet the one piece I think that was missing from their sort of praxeology, if you will, was that sort of spiritual and existential component as to why. And I really believe we're going to make that case in the years ahead. And that will be what defeats AOC and Bernie.
But
it won't be that we get back to a GDP argument.
Well, but I think it's interesting to watch how our cell phones have changed us. And I think back in my own life, because when I went to college, I still didn't send an email until I went to college. I remember life before a cell phone. And now it's just ubiquitous. Like when I just think about all of us, we get into an elevator now and everyone's looking down at their phone. It's just how we live life. And you could take a negative side to that, the amount of time we're spending on social media and the rest. But I believe we're on the cusp of people wanting something a little bit deeper and human connection. And I think a lot of the future enterprise, I think it's going to be, this is the reason I think people like going to dinner, is they like eating food that someone else has created and is interesting. And that act of sitting down at a restaurant and being social with other people is such a key part of what we're made to do. And I think that's going to be part of the next economy, is that yes, technology is going to be important, but I think people who are going to, in companies that are really going to invest in that human to human connection are going to do a lot better than people who are like, punting things off to AI necessarily.
Well, and I also think taking the other side, not just that people will be more satisfied, companies are going to do better. I also think there's a real unique opportunity for labor dynamism, for unique value in the marketplace for people that are bringing distinctly human elements to the job, not merely the relational side, but really virtue, character. You know, there's always been a premium. Employers like employees that don't rip them off more than they do the opposite. But I think that of all the things people talk about AI being able to supposedly disintermediate the worker with, virtue is not going to be one of them.
Right.
There's going to be a premium on humans doing good.
So I read a Harvard Business Review study. And and I actually like their argument. It's something I kind of believed in. They actually said that millennials are so far the hardest working generation that they've ever surveyed. And when you get into it, and you could disagree with what they were looking at, but it showed that a lot of millennial employees, they desire, and it's sometimes you may push back, people may push back, but they want to not just go to work, but they want their work to mean something. Yeah. And you can make fun of it, or you can embrace it as like, that's actually really cool that people are starting to invest personally in the outcomes of their employment. Which when I was growing up, like my grandfathers, it was like they would go to the steel mill and leave the steel mill. And when they would leave the steel mill, they would, you know, drink beer and play horseshoes. But the younger generation wants to make sure that their contributions are going on. This is something you can build upon. That makes me optimistic because it's kind of a humanist approach that they're taking. Now, do I like the wokeness that sometimes is pushed out of it? No, I don't. But do I think there's an opportunity to have different and new conversations with these generations? Do I think they're gone forever? No, I think this is actually going to be some of our opportunities.
I would say that I've read similar studies and observed similar phenomena, and that I tweak things a little bit because I do believe that you're exactly right. They're clearly, in a sort of postmodern sense, searching for deeper meaning in their work, and they're hardworking and they want deeper meaning. The problem I have is that they have become convinced too often that there is meaning in things above and beyond the work that is superior. And you got a lot of this Sam Bankman-Fried toolbox with this effective altruism, in a lot of ways ESG. There's sort of this presumption for too many that the work doesn't have intrinsic meaning, but if we can add to it a certain social consciousness, you know, that was Adam Newman's whole pitch at WeWork. Like, we're not just doing the lowly, unimportant task of office leasing. We're bringing together the world in peace and harmony. And I do think we need to quit falling for these cult-like sucker pitches.
Well, and I just want to go even one thing that I've been very concerned about is it isn't amazing to me, even if you believe all the tenets of global warming, it has become almost a religion.
Oh, sure.
And you have your saints, you have your sinners, you have your contritions that you can do. I mean, it's a freaking religion at this point.
And isn't carbon credits essentially?
It's an indulgence, right?
An indulgence. I don't even know if I'm being mean. Isn't that literally kind of? I think that's a fair way to say it. I don't think that's a straw man.
But you can judge people for their carbon content now, basically. Like, I mean, you are a good person or you're a bad person. So it's what's amazing to me in that is that that has replaced a lot of people's religion. I have these conversations with folks. Like, so if you believe in all the tenets of global warming, shouldn't you be making a massive investment in things like nuclear power? I mean, that seems to me it's a conversation that needs to happen then. And then if you are believing in all this, isn't natural gas just this incredible tool that was given for your transition? And those simple answers can't, because they don't fit the religion. I mean, only windmills are fitting the religion, it seems.
Yeah. So there's all these inconsistencies. And of course, there's factual premise problems. There's illogical movement to conclusion problems. And yet fundamentally, we will do a lot better to critique the opponent with an honesty about what they're doing, which is very much in the religious realm. And it is not a disagreement about science. And that's what is fascinating. So I agree with you completely. We got to find something we disagree with here shortly. Maybe
well, what's your football team? I mean, I'm a diehard Cleveland Browns fan. I could go all day about that.
You know, I'm torn because I actually like you and I like FreedomWorks, and Hugh Hewitt has pissed me off so much on different things with Ohio State that I have found myself rooting against the Cleveland Browns in the last several years because of Hugh and how mercilessly rude he's been to me about USC. He was actually a good friend and I love him. Mm-hmm. You know what? I am excited for your Browns. Mm-hmm. I want to see Deshaun Watson do well. I'm not going to elaborate much there, but I do want to see him do well, and I have my reasons. I don't think you're going to like my team because my team is the team in both college and pro.
Right.
Everybody wants to hate my USC Trojans, and I have been a devout Dallas Cowboy fan since first grade. Now, USC, my father went there. He did his doctoral work there. He got a PhD in philosophy, and I was literally born there. My dad was a student at the time I was born in the early 70s. And I lost my dad young, and USC is my connection to my dad. Sure. And I love USC football more than anything. But the Cowboys, I did a first grade book report on Tom Landry. Mm-hmm. And even though the Rams were in my backyard, and shortly thereafter, the Rams took John Robinson as their coach, who was the coach at USC. But I was just a Cowboy fan through and through because I fell in love with Tom Landry. And now I, of course, was so spoiled and so arrogant in the early 90s when I was out of high school and my young adult life's beginning and the Cowboys are winning Super Bowls every year, 3 out of 4 years, and then haven't won one since.
Right.
And now I've earned whatever success we will hopefully find in the future. I've stuck it out a very long time. Browns fans have stuck it out a long time. And I'm excited. I think that you guys are going to be all right. Don't you?
What I like about football, this goes back in my own family. You know, most of the, you know, all the men in my family are Eastern European thick necks. You know, we're like a race of people born without necks. It's just head on giant bodies, basically. And so football was always something that was interesting to me that's what we could talk about. Because it didn't matter what part of the, you know, a lot of like working class hardcore Democrats in the family, and my dad kind of raised me to be more of a Republican. But man, we could agree on football, and I kind of carried that. It was fun when I would go to college, and you'd go to the Browns backer bars, and it's like white and black and fat and thin and young and old, and everyone rooting, and it was like that was a healthy form of tribalism. And unfortunately, in our society, there's a lot of unhealthy forms of tribalism that pop up. But that's a good one. When you start having these communities that kind of like uplift folks, you know, based on some common sets of values. I mean, that's, you know, I honestly think that's what people are looking for. We don't want to be alone. We want to be part of something that we feel not that just greater than us, but something we contribute to that is helping the human society flourish. And to me, that's the Cleveland Browns.
Well, and here's the thing, whether it is the Cleveland Browns for one or the Cowboys for another, you're speaking to the reality of the human person that is both an individual and social. And so that may sound like it's a football analogy, yep, but it's really profoundly important economically, because anyone who leans only into the individualism of humanity, which is very important, we are unique, we are special. Our lives have meaning apart from our belonging to a collective, especially the collective of the state. But we also are forced to interact with others in the economic dimension. And that's where human flourishing can be found, in that social, relational, communal component. And football is a great way.
You mentioned you're right working on a book. I'm actually working on a book too right now with the guy who founded the Cato Institute, Ed Crane. We're doing a past, present, and future of libertarianism. Yeah. And this is where I start getting optimistic, is that to me there is a what I call small L libertarianism that I believe is actually one of the dominant philosophies in America, particularly if you look at the swing voter. that's where they are. They're kind of small L libertarian, and they're center right. They're pretty socially tolerant, but they're pretty fiscally responsible. But there's this misunderstanding about that. Maybe it's not a misunderstanding. I'm sure there's some of these folks that think libertarian is the guy with an AR-15 on a hilltop in Texas. And to me, libertarians are people who tend to be, they work with folks. That's what they do. Most libertarian minded people I know tend to be that work in very urban areas, and they love people, and they're optimistic that people can solve problems. And again, going back to the global warming thing, the libertarians I know look at global warming as a problem to be solved. And you can do that through technology, and you can use it through a whole lot of things. And they're optimistic, like, yeah, you can solve cancer. You can solve going to Mars. You can solve all of these things. But we collaborate, we work together, and individuals bring their strengths to the team. And then when I look at the other side, they're pessimistic, and it's like, man, we need the government to save us from all of that. And that to me is, that's an opportunity. I think I can win that argument every day.
Well, I agree completely. Let's do, before we wrap a bit, let's talk a bit of, here and now economics. You know, we talked about the House, the election, where things are, I think you're right. The Senate House prospects in 2024. The only thing I would add, by the way, I think that we'll probably lose the House because of the ebb and flow of how things go in 2 years. And I definitely think we should be very optimistic about our prospects for taking back the Senate. And then there's so many question marks what will happen around the 2024 presidential race. The only thing I would say is I do not think we would have lost the House from the natural cyclicality of 2 years had we ended up with the lead that we really should have. And I don't mean 40 and 35 that some people were predicting, but if we had ended up with a 25 margin, mm-hmm. I'd feel safer. 25 to 30, I'd feel safer. So I think you're right, though, that we're entering that midterm, that next election after this midterm too thin.
So that's just what history has said. But Republicans, if you look at a lot of the numbers, Republicans did really well in Republican areas. That's the thing. It's just they didn't do really well in the 30 districts that mattered. And that's multiple episodes on why that is. But a lot of it comes down to me, the lack of message. I still have a hard time. If you asked me, put a gun to my head, what is a Republican? I have a hard time coming up with a really good definition for what a Republican is. I have an easier time describing that it's not a Democrat than what a Republican is. And I think the failure to do a contract like this is the stuff we're going to do, that hurt them. But also Republicans have to get off of this, like we have to only vote on Election Day. Elections are over on October 15th, not Election Day. Vote by mail is here to stay. It's not going anywhere. And so that's the mechanics of electioneering that Team GOP has to learn, that I prefer we have a national holiday and everyone shows up on Election Day and we all go eat barbecue together. But the reality is the future of elections, they're going to be vote by mail. They're going to be absentee. And so that's a lesson coming out of this election.
Agree completely. You can complain about anything you want, but don't deny that it exists. And now you got to go exploit it, make it work to your advantage.
Hey, Ron DeSantis did in Florida. It's not impossible for Republicans to play this game.
So I want to say, because you and I were on the same side of the COVID divide. I went and visited you at your offices in D.C., and I was appalled at how locked down D.C. was still a year and a half into COVID. You were living in it. I believed that the COVID moment represented a threat to freedom, that a free society, even one that is often politically all over the place and even economically all over the place, but the basic belief that we can take our kid to the park was not going to go over well. And in the election results, I feel like there's conflicting signals. On one hand, Brian Kemp won by a really impressive margin in Georgia. Ron DeSantis' historical performance in Florida. Those seem like signifiers that, the electorate agreed with me. And by the way, even though my buddy Adam Laxalt ended up losing barely in the Senate seat in Nevada, the one incumbent out of every Senate seat and every governor seat, the one incumbent who lost was a COVID tyrant Democrat governor in Nevada who lost to a Republican candidate in the purple state of Nevada. So I look at those races and I go, okay, the people are with me and Adam in really resenting the anti-science and anti-freedom mantra of so many throughout the COVID moment. But then other races, I got two things I got to jump in on.
First of all, in Nevada, and this is based on what I can figure out right now, the Lexalt team spent $0 on the ground game. Zero. And the governor, Republican governor, spent $3.5 million. On election day, the governor was up by 5 points. Lexalt was up by 3. The late ballots come in. Lexalt gets washed out. Governor wins. It shows the importance of having a ground game right there. The second thing is a new story that I'm still trying to wrap my heads around right now. And I saw it earlier today. China's starting to lift its COVID policy all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. You had just a little bit of pushback. And I want to talk about people who are courageous. There was a kid who had a sign saying something like Chinese shouldn't be sheep. And he held it up, walked around a street corner, and then was bundled into a van. And he's probably going to spend the next 20 years of his life in a prison. Talk about a hero. But my God, the CCP buckled to that pressure real fast. And I think we're going to look back on that as either one, that was just they let some of the steam go, or is that the beginning and the end of the CCP?
Well, that will be very interesting to see. I guess I'd have more optimism that China was headed towards the beginning of the end of the CCP out of their COVID protest if I had seen the Virginia results be the beginning of the end of the, teachers' unions, right? I mean, we didn't exactly parlay our COVID frustrations into a lasting enough movement here in the States yet where we have fertilized freedom. So I think in China, it's gonna take a little longer. But
go back to Virginia, because this is something, if I wasn't working here at FreedomWorks, I would want to be working on micro schools, because I believe micro schools are the future, where you return almost to a one-room schoolhouse where you have one or two teachers and 30 students, and you customize education for those students, and they don't fall through the cracks. And it's I think that's the future. There is such an opportunity now still. That is a lasting impact from this COVID, as people have been opened up. There might be alternative ways for education. And that battle's not over yet. That's something I want to spend more time working on, both at FreedomWorks and on my own personal time. I'm actually trying to figure out how to start a school for my own kids. And if I could figure out how to work and start a school for my kids and my neighbor's kids, a community-based school for our neighborhood, oh man, if I can learn how to do that, that's something we could possibly bring nationally.
Yeah, well, and I think that alternative ways of pursuing education and things, I started and sit on the board of a Christian high school program in Orange County, California, and there's just no question that there was a massive increase in interest and inquiry. The homeschool movement, other private schools, micro school, classical school, a lot of these formats definitely have benefited. And look, it's an unrealistic expectation for me to have thought that every parent who was pissed off at the union in 2020 would keep that anger going into 22, 23. I tend to keep my anger going. I mean, I said, there were people during COVID, I said, I'm not forgiving them. You know, they're going to calm down and they're going to pretend it never happened. And they're going to start saying more reasonable things in the future. But I remember what they did. And it does seem a lot of parents in the country had a justifiable and righteous anger 2 years ago, and it has sort of simmered down.
But I also think there is just a revolution going on in general education. One of my, over the weekend, I forget the name of the app. It's something that Elon Musk invested in. And it's an AI tool where you could ask it questions, and it spits out incredibly strong answers. Stuff like this is going to allow a 15-year-old to become a master mechanic. And you start asking, just as we get some of the good side of technology, you're going to fundamentally change what the whole reason for university education is. So there's, in any problem, there's a yin and a yang. There's a good thing and a bad thing that comes out of any change. But right now there's just such an opportunity with education. I think we're rethinking the whole thing from when you are a kid to college. I mean, there's no vocational schools. But I think it's really important in all of this. And we talk about school choice is it's bringing the middle class into it. Rich kids could go to whatever school they want to go to. And thankfully poor kids are getting a lot more opportunities through vouchers, but I want that guy who sells car insurance and his wife, who's a nurse, who are solidly in the middle class, to be able to have the option to send their kid to whatever school they want to go to.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I agree entirely. So school choice is an example of an issue that can be pretty nonpartisan or bipartisan. And we've seen that in the past in things in Ohio and in Arizona. Yeah. What are other issues right now that you think in this polarized, tribalistic political moment are economic or cultural issues that can cross the political divide besides school choice?
Well, I don't want to be pessimistic, but in the next 2 years, I'm not seeing a whole lot because there's just such a tribal and it's such a split. And the problem with when you have a government that's so evenly divided, you can't give up an inch. And that's just kind of the way the cycle works right now. But I'll also say is one of that we talked about COVID earlier. And one of the reasons I'm pessimistic about the immediate circumstances is I am unaware of an American crisis that we've ever come out of weaker than we went into. World War II rallied the country. 9/11 rallied the country. COVID has torn us apart. Absolutely. And so I think it's going to take, I haven't seen my family as much as I used to, period. I haven't spent some time with my friends as much as I used to. And so we're slowly, like before I came on this, I'm texting with my friends about, hey, let's all get together at a cabin this year and, you know, bring our wives and kids. And we haven't really done that in a long time. So I think some of I think the American reconnection with friends and family has to start to happen before we start having some policy wins. Maybe some of the stuff on China, I think there's some great understanding right now on the importance of chips. And some of those existential threats. So I wouldn't be surprised about that as an area where you could start to see some overlap. But a lot of that's industry led as well at this point. I wouldn't be surprised. And I don't want to, now I'm totally getting out of my skis on over my skis on this, but I wouldn't be surprised if you had a recession next year. And then of course, whenever you put a recession in, that does change. You know, when I went to school, like we have an inverted yield curve, you're going to have a recession sometime, right? But so I think that's going to have a souring effect on politics. I'm just sounding negative on the areas you can work on, but I think it's got to get a little worse before it gets better.
Yeah. Well, let me economically chime in on the recession talk. I think that there's a possibility, and this is not predictive, but it's a scenario to consider. We had a recession in 2002, and it was the aftermath of the dot-com implosion and a lot of very, very perversely overpriced risk assets that were in a bubble, and it popped. The Fed helped pop it. And
easy money at Y2K, all that.
You have that. You did then have 9/11, which is a sort of different thing altogether that represented, for a lot of reasons, a profound change in certain aspects of American life. But I don't think 2002, that recession, proved to be all that monumental. I don't think most people knew we were having one.
That's true.
And I don't think most people cared. And yet, there were people who got really hurt economically. And you know who they were? They were the people who owned pets.com and had leveraged up on margin, you know, Netscape and other things like that. It's possible that what we end up having out of this moment is the ridiculous asset prices in certain parts of the crypto space and in certain parts of the technology sector and small cap growth, that you have risk takers who get just washed out. And maybe there's a mild recession. I've thought all year long this talk about a jobful recession. Yep. Like they talk about,
I was going to ask you that next. Yeah.
A jobless recovery is not a recovery, and a jobful recession is not a recession because of vocabulary. Now people are even adding to it that maybe corporate profits won't come down that much. And so I'm trying to figure out, well, so you don't have profit erosion or job erosion and you have a recession. I'm not totally clear as to what that is. And so if you're going to have recession, profits are going to come down. If you're going to have recession, unemployment's going to go up. And that is sort of tautologically true.
Yeah.
Either way, I would say that the COVID thing you brought up, I'm not optimistic that we have a certain unifying event anytime soon. And other than, you know, one that could be particularly horrific, and I'm not sure a horrific one would be unifying again because COVID proved not to be.
Right.
But on the margin, certain pockets, like on a policy front, that maybe people in Landon County, Virginia, get together around school issues and abuses from the local school board. On a national level, I agree with you about school choice, but I got to say, I think this environmental extremism, I think it may have peaked.
Well, okay, here's something I'll point out on that. What is winter going to look like in Europe?
It does look like they're going to have a better winter than expected.
Okay, well, but it's still, I went to Scotland a couple of months ago, and you know, we took our little kid, and the whole idea was, I love pubs because if your kid's screaming, no one gives you a side eye in a pub. If you're in a restaurant, your kid starts screaming, you know, that's rude. All the pubs in Scotland that we were going to in these towns were closed, all of them. And I started asking, well, why is that? And it was energy costs. It was just, the energy costs in these pubs were so high that there's no way they could make money opening up their doors. And I even if it's not as bad as people predict, it's still Europeans are getting nailed with energy.
Absolutely.
And I think that it's going to be hard to keep that off of TikTok and people complaining about this. And at some point, you got to look at Europe. I mean, Europe's energy crisis is self-made.
So is America's. And Europe's energy crisis is more severe. They were more dependent on a particular authoritarian. But we have an opportunity cost problem and an ongoing OPEC dependency problem. And yet so far, it does look like weather, everything is way worse than it needs to be in Europe, and it's hurting pocketbooks of people. The sort of apocalyptic predictions is what I was saying don't appear to be surfacing because the winter has been a bit more mild. And so the gas impact, natural gas price impact in particular. But I think that you have a lot of people that are pretty much leftist that are saying we need more coal in Germany. I think you have tons of people in America that are saying, yeah, eventually I like net zero, but you know, in the meantime, why don't we go ahead and get a little more crude production going?
Well, here's a collision course. If you're going to have your green dreams and your battery dreams, I tell you what, rare earths are not clean, and that process. So I think that, you know, there's a potential area for Republicans and Democrats to agree upon. It's like, if you're going to make this move to these areas, you got to reopen these mines, and producing rare earths is not clean. Producing chips is not clean. These are a ton of water, a ton of energy, and you're going to need all of these things for your green revolution. So I think there's some reality that's going to come in, and maybe there's compromise you can make on that, because if we're going to go down this road, I'd surely you can't be dependent on China for your rare earths minerals. And we've got a lot of them here.
So that's right. There's a pragmatism and a kind of forced, as you say, you get to a collision, and then certain things have to kind of shake out a little bit. And some good things could come out of that. We need to be in the position to win the argument and then, of course, win the policy debate. But I think we have the right side of the issues. And so then it's really the burden's on us. I guess that's where organizations like FreedomWorks, National Review, and others come in. I don't know. I think we need to win elections, Adam. I do. But I don't. I think that we need to do a lot more before we win elections. And
I think you would. Politics is downstream of the culture. I know it's a cliche thing to say, but it's so true. One thing I look at my friends on the left, they use the off election years to set the tone. They use C3 dollars to try and set people's visions, and then it's easier to win politics the next year. Republicans, you know, we actually, in a lot of races, you could point to Republicans being outspent. Republicans have plenty of money. Democrats have plenty of money for politics. It's this outside building up the arguments and using 501c3s. That's where you really see the left's advantage. And that's like, by our calculations, that's about $8 billion to $1.5 billion advantage.
Yeah. And it permeates throughout arts, throughout media, throughout education. There's just a tremendous use of cultural institutions. And I disagree with everything they're doing and saying, but they do it really well.
Yes, they do.
They do it really effectively. And so that's, you look, I don't even think our Browns Cowboys debate was really all that severe. We're brothers from a different mother, but I appreciate all you're doing. I do want to ask Capitol Record listeners to stay connected to what FreedomWorks is doing. They're organized, they're thoughtful, and they have a wonderful leader in Adam Brandon. Adam, thanks for joining us on Capitol Record.
Well, I look forward to visiting with you one of these next days, and I'm up in New York, and thanks very much for having me.
And thank you all for listening. We will be back yet again with another guest, another episode. Look forward to finishing the year strong. We'll ask you to trust us that the algorithms matter to promote our podcast, to get it out there. And algorithms are impacted by you liking us, reviewing us, rating us. So if you could do your part to hit that little thumbs up or give us 5 stars or something, it goes a long way. I hate saying it, but I got to tell you, it makes a difference. And in the meantime, we look forward to coming back to you next week with another episode of Capitol Record.